Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Jamie Attenberg, whose new novel is A Reason to See You Again. Attenberg's novels of complicated family life are moving and unforgettable, and her new one, A Reason to See You Again, may be her best yet. This novel captures 40 years in the lives of the Cohen women, mother Frida, daughters Nancy and Shelley, and then later granddaughter Jess, and their friends. And it is such a pleasure to welcome Jamie back to The Reading Life to celebrate her 10th book.
Oh my gosh. Hi, Susan. It's
Jamie,
nice to see you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh.
Thanks.
Now, the last time you were here, we were talking about 1,000 Words of Summer.
Yep.
So I have to ask you, how did it go this year?
It went really well. It was really cool. It was great to tour for it. Like, I did a lot of really cool events.
Yeah.
Like, we did all these ride-alongs, which was really neat. I tried to go to cities that I hadn't been to before. So I went to Jacksonville and Greensboro. And I mean, I did stuff in New York and D.C. too. But it was, I liked going to these new places and having these, you know, great ride-alongs and teaching workshops and stuff like that. And really have gotten such positive feedback on it. And yeah, it was really like, it's a much easier to launch a book like that than it is to launch a book like this.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you have 1,000 Words of Summer up and running now as an effort.
Yes.
So you can kind of step right into it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm definitely like in it for the long haul. So yeah, it's nice. It's nice to have something you can point to and say, there's this kind of, it's not weird, but it's sort of a quirky thing that people do online. And then there's this physical object that I can point to and say, this is, you know, you could just take this with you and learn from that.
Now, this book had already been finished by then.
Yes.
So you must have been working on something else.
I am on a new book. Yeah, I am on book 11 now. Yeah, I'm probably like 30,000 words into a new book. I don't know. I need a hobby or something. I don't know. But I like it. I like writing. It's really soothing to me.
Well, there you go. Find Jamie Attenberg a hobby.
Yes. That's as comforting
what would
to
that
me.
Be?
I don't know. I mean, I like messing around in my garden, but
yeah.
Yeah. But like, I like to get up every day and work on stuff.
Well, I'm glad you do.
Thanks.
Now, I want to ask you to read the opening scene of this book, A Reason to See You Again, because games may change, but feelings are always the same. Mm. And this is such a recognizable family moment.
Okay. And the book is spans like 40 years. So chapter one starts in 1971. Oh, the games families play with each other. In the Cohen household, it was Scrabble, and they played it every Saturday night. This is one of Frida's rules. Telephone unplugged, the whole family together. The girls were still young enough that they had nowhere urgent to be but right there. Nancy, 16, Shelley, 12. Idling in the living room with their father, Rudy, while Frida made popcorn in the kitchen. Tonight, Lawrence Welk led some orchestral tribute to America on the television set. Rudy nodding his head along to the music. Rudy, frail, angular, fading, but loving and present. A real bon vivant when he had the energy. I want him alive, thought Frida. I must feed him. A frantic feeling. Him. She must take care of him. She salted and buttered the popcorn in good, thick, fatty layers, humming as she delivered it in a Tupperware bowl to the family who sat, sunken in a green velvet conversation pit, a lucite table at the center, set up with a game board. A family waiting. Press play. Shelley clapped for the popcorn. It smells divine, she said. What a delicious and satisfying treat. Shelley, always trying on words for size, she popped one piece after another into her mouth. She liked to have something to do with her hands. A place to direct her nervous energy, thought Frida. This whole family was nervous. Everyone was worried about Rudy, who had been sick and then not sick and then sick again. It had been this way for years. Malnutrition in his youth, in the camps, and all the stress then and always. Now he had a bad heart. He was 41 and looked 60. A little worse this year, but then again, what did worse mean when things have been bad for so long? So it was good for them to be all together, thought Frida, every Saturday, a regular moment for the family, private, after the crowds at Shoal the night before. But also, she wanted to win at Scrabble. The girls were good at the game, competitive enough to keep things interesting. Frida had taught them some tricks. All the two-letter words, the most potent available ways to use Q and X, their little sponge minds preparing for their next moves. There was Nancy organizing her tiles to be just so. She liked it when ideas clicked together easily and was sharp enough to find a few five- or six-letter words here and there. A tidy girl, demure, pretty, mildly interested in lots of things, but not one thing in particular. She'd do all right, thought Frida, at this game in life.
I love that. It's such a way, you know, a mother looks at her family and thinks, how will they do? What do they know? What have I taught them?
You yes.
know, it's very sharp and yep. smart. But this is a book about family secrets and the ways families communicate and the way things blow apart and come back together. It's no accident that there's a pink princess phone on the cover, which I love. I love.
The phone, yeah. yeah. I think it makes some people have feelings, that phone.
Yeah.
I've been hearing that from people. Yeah. And then generationally, there are some people who look at it and I think it may not have no meaning to them at all, unfortunately. But
what is that curious object?
Yes, exactly. yeah, for sure. I mean, my niece is 19 and did not grow up with a phone in her house. So, yeah.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that wild? Maybe when she was really young, there might have been a landline, but yeah.
So you were working on this book during the pandemic and you were looking at things on Instagram and online and you came up with all these objects and clothes that were the fun aunt clothes.
Yes. Yeah.
Speaking of your niece. So
right.
Are you the fun aunt?
I don't know. I am the aunt. Oh, there's another aunt too. She might be fun also. We might all be fun, to be fair. It is definitely like, I think it might be kind of my pandemic novel in terms of like what I was like sort of, I agree with you, like I was sort of like thinking about the past and doing lots of research. And I think there was something about the pandemic that like we were kind of stuck in the moment, but also mm-hmm. thinking about how we got to where we were. And so I think that's part of like why this book is spans everything kind of leading up to, you know, it ends in 2007, I think. But it's like it was sort of a look back as much as anything else.
Right.
You know, if you know what I mean. I actually like originally was going to have the last chapter of the book be set now or 2 years ago when I started writing it. And mm-hmm. then I just thought I didn't feel like I needed that at all, that it was sort of implied. We all know where we're going yeah. to. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of like clothes in this book and there's a lot of fashion and there's sort of the way that women are looked at and what their clothes say about them in America, yeah. in the corporate world, how men view them. And I wanted to kind of explore that. I had this one character, Shelley Cohen, who is, as you said, the cool aunt or the fun aunt. And she is somebody who's involved with the emerging cell phone industry at the
right.
Yes. And so she's working with like an all-male office and she sort of has to evolve her looks and appearance to kind of fit in there, to sort of be somehow like not overly attractive, non-threatening, but not too masculine. And she sort of like it gets imposed upon by different men in her office. And I just put a lot of thought into that.
And the men in this novel are interesting, too.
Yeah, they're...
You've gotten some sharp criticism
Yeah, I mean, they're... they're supporting characters. This is definitely...
Right.
Yes, they're definitely like... it's about the women, and sometimes we see the men through their gaze. And it was a different time, you know, we're talking about men in the 80s as opposed to men now. And yeah, there's definitely like a critique of like men with wandering eyes.
Definitely.
Yes, in this book. But, you know, all my characters are flawed and viewed with love, but also viewed with a gimlet eye as well.
Well, one of the flawed but lovable characters in this book is Rudy.
Yeah.
And his death is really what propels the Cohen family forward into this kind of explosion and splintering. There's something about him that makes you feel so tenderly toward him when you're reading about him. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, he just showed up. All my characters always just kind of show up. But he's somebody who, I'm always like, I don't want to give too much away, but I think this is all in the first chapter anyway. Mm-hmm. But he is somebody who was in, you know, the Holocaust. He's a Holocaust survivor. He was in the camps when he was a teenager. He came to the U.S. and he was somebody who got invited to tell his story across the country when people were interested in hearing his story. And then they were less interested in hearing his story. And he sort of had to figure out a way, like a new identity for himself. He's also somebody who is gay and in the closet and is sort of like known in his family, but not talked about. Again, when we go back to the family secrets aspect of it. But he's very beloved and really good to his family. He really loves his family.
He's very lovable.
I enjoyed spending time with him. I'm sorry I had to kill him off in the first chapter.
But he's, I see a trend.
But he's sort of like, yes. But he definitely, he sort of is filtered throughout the book. He has his little moments when he pops up again.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jamie Attenberg, whose new book is A Reason to See You Again. There's so many hidden things in this novel and so many hiding places. I was quite charmed by that because I can imagine you sitting at your desk thinking, well, I'll have them hide this there.
Right. Yeah, you always see like objects, like you see like a trunk, you know, or you see, and you're like, what's in the trunk? I mean, that's like the most amazing writing prompt in the world is just like a trunk in a basement. Anything could be, anything. This is your writing prompt for the day, right? Like anything can be in that. How old is that trunk? How did it get there? There's actually like boxes that get moved from like one house to another house to another house.
I love that.
Over the story of the book, and they sort of like get open when they need to be open. So there's a car that sort of gets moved around too, and so there's all these objects sort of it's very playful for me to move all these objects around all over the place.
Well, I had fun finding them with you later. It's also a real portrait of sibling rivalry. So talk a little bit about that.
I never had a sister. I only had a brother. But I have female friends. and I have friends who have sisters. And I think that women can be competitive with each other in a certain kind of way. Men can be competitive with each other, too. But I guess I was just interested in exploring this. They're two very different people, Nancy and Shelley. Shelley is somebody who is like a career gal. Mm-hmm. Nancy marries very young and is a mother and is constantly trying to find her way and what she wants to do with herself. And she's really into the self-help movement and exploring who she is and trying to find the right answer. Whereas Shelley is very just go, go, go. And is just finding herself through her work. And so when they are not feeling generous towards each other, let's put it that way.
It's a lovely way to put it.
Yes. Then they can snap at each other, or they can feel competitive, or they cannot speak to each other for months at a time. But they always come back to each other. They always find their way back to each other. And it's just both the curse and the blessing of our lives as family members, you know.
It's the bedrock. They're always there.
Yes, they are always there. And they know you better than anyone else.
But it's not just the male gaze. So much of this book is about the female gaze as well. It's not just the way Nancy and Shelley look at one another, but the way they look at their friends.
Yes.
The way the niece looks at Shelley and looks at her mother and judgy.
Very little of this book is that there's only a handful of moments where you see things through a male gaze, through that close third person. It's the female gaze reacting to the male gaze is what we're getting some of the time. And then the female gaze reacting to the female gaze. They can be judgy. You know, they were raised in a household that was judgy. So those things do get passed down. And they weren't really necessarily taught to love themselves.
Right.
And I think sometimes when you don't love yourself, you can like turn it outward towards other people and not love them too. I think the judgment comes from that. They're really complicated people, but I really understood them. And hopefully, ultimately, people can see that there's love there, and also to kind of tussle with it, where how they would handle the same situation and how they would feel about the same situation. Sometimes it's like you can show compassion and openness in a work by just like being really explicit about it. And sometimes you invite the reader to have a conversation with the book and with themselves about it.
Mm-hmm. It's not only about sibling rivalry, though. It's about female friendship in such a rich way. I mean, I think of Frida's friend, Carolina.
Yes.
Or Carolina.
I think Carolina.
Carolina, I love that.
That's how I heard it, yeah.
They're moving to Miami, it's Carolina.
Yes.
And then Margaret, of course.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I love all the friendships. That's the chosen family, as it were. Carolina is someone who works with Frida, who is a healthcare worker. She works as a nursing aide, and she and Carolina leave and move to Miami together after both of her kids have left home for college. And they look out for each other until they don't. Mm-hmm. And then Margaret is a coworker with Shelley in Seattle. And she's probably the cool aunt.
Yeah,
she's the coolest
really
character out of all of them, in my opinion. And she's really inspired by all these like amazing female electronic composers that I studied and did lots of research on that and the history of women working in tech. And there really was a crossover between these women who were working with synthesizers and making all this amazing music and also working in the tech world. So that's my little tribute to that. And Margaret is a musician who sort of spends a little time working in the tech world, and that's how she meets Shelley. And they have a very like loving but sometimes a little tempestuous, a little bit of a tempestuous relationship too.
I think Margaret had the best clothes.
Margaret has the coolest clothes. Margaret has the coolest life. Margaret has kind of a tough life, too. She's definitely has some, like, you know, mental health issues that are challenging. Yeah, their relationship was really fun to write.
But their work was also fun to read about. I mean, I love the way you take work so seriously and give it its due and develop it in a person's life and show that role growing and changing and, you know, over time.
There was like a point where this book was just going to be called like Working Gal or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Because I really wanted to write about the relationship of women to work. And again, how that has evolved over 40 years and how that. So there's all these characters that are front and center, but there's also all these themes and all these things that I researched that I hope are like layered throughout, like women and work and the way how we communicated with each other 40 years ago and and how it's changed now and having her work, having Shelley be responsible for parts of the evolution of the cell phone, you know, working in that industry and having her commentary on it as it evolved along the way. You know, all of that was of interest to me, and that impacts these women's lives. It impacts the male characters' lives also as well. Yeah. But, I mean, those are the people who are sort of at the forefront of the book. Yeah, but women and their jobs, like, not all women want to work, but a lot of women do. And I think we're all just, like, looking for the thing that makes us happy and fulfilled in our lives.
But also what has to be done. I mean, when I think of the healthcare work, for example, that's not particularly glamorous or, you know, but it must be done. And the way you describe that is so detailed and compassionate and understanding of its necessity.
Yes, it's true. I mean, working with people who are at the, you know, end of care or end of life care I worked in a nursing home a million years ago. So I have been around it and have, you know, witnessed other people in my life that I know are going through, you know, later in life kind of stuff. And it wasn't that it was joyful or pleasant to spend time considering it, but it was good for my heart to spend time thinking about those things.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jamie Attenberg, whose new book is A Reason to See You Again. Time itself is one of the great themes of this novel. How much time do we have? What do we do with it? You know, and how we use it, you know, and the tricks time plays on us. And I wonder if you had to be you now to write this book.
Yeah, I don't think I could have written this book 20 years ago when I just started writing fiction. I definitely think I'm writing it from a more educated, wiser place. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be 53 soon. So I don't think it was something me when I was 35 years old. That was when I wrote my first novel. I don't think I would have been writing this story or thinking about this story in this particular way. I do think there is some youthfulness to the story.
That's in Jess.
Yes.
So much of it's in Jess.
Yes. The niece, Jess. But I am thinking now in my life about a span of a life more than just a moment in time. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I wanted to write about with this because I had the memoir that came out a couple of years ago that like spanned so many years and so many cities. And I feel like my last couple novels were really compact and tight and set during over the course of a day or in a, you know, in a specific city. And so I wanted to write something that spanned time and thought more about like the breadth of a, the scope of a life, scope of lives. Mm-hmm. And so this book gave me that opportunity to just send people, just to see people at all these different ages and see what they become as I think about these things now.
Well, it felt like you were, parts of it were leisurely. I'm going to consider this for a while. And, you know, there was this lovely description. And then you'd sit there with the book and you think, yeah, that's really the way it is.
Yeah, that's nice to hear.
You know, and it's it felt elongated somehow and richer.
That's really nice to say.
You know what I mean?
Thank you so much. Yeah, the pacing is different. I don't know. I wrote it different. You know, you write things in a different time in your life. You write things, I mean, writing during the pandemic is different. You know, writing mm-hmm. as a person now in their 50s is different. All those kinds of things impact the way that you work. When I was young, I just thought, I mean, what is young? I don't know. 30s to me feels young, but now I'm like that. It wasn't even that young, but younger anyway. I mean, I just had so many ideas and I just wanted to get them out on the page and everything felt right and correct and true. And then the older you get, you sort of think just because you can say it doesn't mean necessary. You know, it's good to say it and feel it and write it down and think about things in the moment, but a little reflection is always worth it.
Well, 10 books in. So how do you feel about this one?
I have not. I'm thank you for bringing up 10 because I have not really thought about it yet. It's like sort of in the back of my mind. It feels significant.
It's a nice chunk of bookshelf.
I'm looking forward to posting something on Instagram with all my books next to each other.
Good.
But I don't know. I guess I'm glad I made it this far because it's really hard to be a working artist. So 10 books over 18 years, something like that.
That's amazing, Jamie.
It's a lot of books. Yeah.
It's a lot of discipline and hard work. And
yeah. Don't make me cry on air. I'll do it.
No.
But I don't know. I can't believe I did it. But I don't know what else I would do.
Well, made me cry on the last page. So turnabout's fair play. So there.
Then I have succeeded if I made you cry.
You have succeeded, indeed. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jamie Attenberg, whose new novel is A Reason to See You Again. You can meet her when she appears with interviewer Patricia Lockwood Sunday, September 22nd, in a ticketed event sponsored by Blue Cypress Books. And again, Thursday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Ricky Smiley presents Sideshow, an evening of laughter, tears, and hope, in conversation with Pastor Jonathan Everett. Friday, September 20th at 5:30 at Baldwin & Company. Doors open at 4:30. This is a ticketed event. The Silent Book Club meets from 6 to 7:30 Friday, September 20th at Blue Cypress Books. Charlemagne Degaud appears in conversation with Cherise Gibson about his new book, Get Honest or Die Lying, Why Small Talk Sucks. Friday, September 20th at 7:30 at Baldwin & Company. Tickets available at Eventbrite. Stephen Ray, author of the Katrina memoir, Finn McCool's Football Club, will lead two sessions at 9:30, Mistakes Every Writer Makes, and at 11, Life as a Writer, Amateur or Professional, at the September edition of the Writers' Clinic, beginning 9:30, Saturday, September 21st, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Free, no need to pre-register. Gregory Ricks signs Retirement Deserves a Helpful Hand, a guide to the destination you deserve. Saturday, September 21st at 2 at Blue Cypress Books. Jamie Attenberg appears in conversation with Patricia Lockwood to discuss her new novel, A Reason to See You Again. Sunday, September 22nd from 4:30 to 7 at an event sponsored by Blue Cypress Books. It's a ticketed event and the address will be sent to ticket holders only. Attenberg also appears Thursday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tripp Friedler appears in conversation with Executive Director of the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Nick Richard, to discuss The Tunnel, a memoir. Tuesday, September 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ann Patchett and illustrator Robin Price Glasser discuss and sign their new children's book, The Verts, a story of introverts and extroverts. Wednesday, September 25th at 4:30 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. New Orleans-based reporter and critic Sarah Jaffe discusses From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire, Thursday, September 26th from 6 to 8 at the Saturn Bar. Melissa Martin discusses and signs Bayou, Feasting Through the Seasons of Cajun Life, Thursday, September 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. The exhibit, A Distinguished Trajectory, Reshaping Histories at the Latin American Library, celebrates 100 years of Latin American studies at Tulane and tells the story of Tulane's long-standing engagement with Latin America through the library's many treasures. There will be an opening reception Friday, September 27th from 5 to 7 at the library, which is located on the fourth floor of Howard Tilton Library at Tulane. The Faulkner Society Fall Festival, Faulkner for All, begins Friday, September 27th and features keynote speaker Lawrence William Coates, best-selling author Thomas Mallon, Elizabeth Williams, founder of the National Food and Beverage Foundation and the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, Sella Palmer, and special guest of honor Marcel Bienvenu, whose classic Who's Your Mama, Are You Catholic, and Can You Make a Roux will be issued in a new edition this fall. Poet-publisher Bill Lavender is also a guest of honor. For complete information, check out www.faulknersociety.org or email faulkhouse@aol.com. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at The Reading Life at WWNO.org.